Welcome back to The Metabolomist. In this episode, I am joined by Sandy Azam. Together, we bring the topic of metabolomic epidemiology back to the podcast, and we discuss where metabolomics can provide maximum impact. We explore the surprising sex differences revealed by metabolomics in childhood obesity that already exist in children under the age of 5. We also discuss how to apply the fundamentals of epidemiology when designing metabolomic studies, and we touch upon the importance of investigating ethnic diversity in precision medicine. Listen in on this episode and don't forget to connect on LinkedIn to continue the conversation that we start today with Sandy Azam. Welcome back to The Metabolomist for a third season, where we will dive into the concrete applications of metabolomics and where this tool will impact society in the next 5 to 10 years. I am your host, Alice Limonciel, and this year I am joined by a diverse group of scientists, medical doctors, and other professionals who have used metabolomics and pushed it beyond just descriptive studies and towards applications that will or are already impacting people's lives. This year, the keyword is really impact. Like you, I know the potential of metabolomics. In the last two seasons, I've discussed with many metabolomists about how powerful, sensitive, and informative metabolomics can be. But this year, I want to zoom in on the impact, the applications that are or soon will be changing our lives for the better. Welcome back to The Metabolomist. Today, I'm joined by Sandy Azam. Hello.
Hi, Alice. Thank you for having me.
Hi, thank you for being here. Sandy, you're a research associate at McMaster University in Canada. Could you tell us a little bit about your work and the use that you make of metabolomics in your work?
My pleasure. My PhD was in chemical biology in Philip Brice McGibbon's lab at McMaster University, and it combined fundamental method development and clinical translation. With the method development, we worked with, which not many people work with, capillary electrophoresis mass spectrometry, and that combined with a technique developed in our lab called multi-segment injection, where you're injecting 7 to 13 samples at one run, so it increases throughput by a lot. I've developed a method for fatty acid analysis, looking to non-esterified fatty acids, so we did not need to hydrolyze, we did not need to derivatize. So it was really fundamental analytical chemistry, another similar method for PFAS, so those perfluoroalkyl substances. But also, because it was a chemical biology program, it gave me an opportunity to see the applications of metabolomics. So I did a metabolomic analysis into a disease called peripheral artery disease, which is a heart attack in the legs. So it's due to atherosclerosis and it occurs in older age. A risk factor is smoking and it causes anything between severe pain into the extreme case of needing limb amputation. We did a metabolomic analysis into those different stages of the disease, and that got me into the world of clinical applications of metabolomics, which is where I am at now, but more focused on metabolomic epidemiology in maternal and child health. In 2020, I defended my PhD and then transitioned with our collaborator into Department of Medicine at McMaster. And there I worked mainly in birth cohorts, transitioned from the wet work into statistics and using the data that's generated in metabolomics to look into cardiometabolic risk factors early on. There's a framework for it called DOHAD, or Developmental Origins of Health and Disease, where the hypothesis tells you that what happens in utero affects the health of the offspring in childhood, but also later on in adulthood. So we're trying to track the early origins of cardiovascular disease, so looking into gestation diabetes, metabolic syndrome in children. So these have been mainly the major projects of my postdoctoral fellowship.
Thank you. That's a lot of very interesting things. And a lot of this we will find in the paper that we discuss later in the episode. So you have this chemistry background, like really developing the methods yourself. And then you haven't stopped there. You've looked into the application and understanding what that means, right? So you didn't stop at the chemistry. You wanted to go towards the application and what that means for the patients in the end, I have the feeling.
Yeah. I am a pharmacist by training, and I think that also fostered that passion where you find chemistry meeting biology. In pharmacy, you're saying this is very, very focused on pharmacological drugs, medications, and mechanisms, but to answer biological questions. And that's similar exactly where I'm finding I'm more most productive and most passionate is using the chemistry. But you have to have a very good basic understanding of the metabolomics of and then use that into clinical applications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this may be why you have this interest in metabolomics as well, because it's really a field where you combine biology and chemistry into one thing.
Yeah.
A lot of your work has to do with, as you mentioned, so with the factors that will increase the risk for cardiovascular disease and looking into this. So either during pregnancy or in young children. And we look into a paper in young children under the age of 5, where I'm fascinated to see the differences, especially at that age, between boys and girls already. Mm-hmm. And also to see that you see the children are obese, but you see it's like serious metabolic signatures for these, yeah, these children already, which is quite worrisome. Can you tell us a bit more about the relevance of metabolomics for epidemiology in general? So you look at specific parts of the population, but genetics historically is really the omic that has been used predominantly, I think, in epidemiology. Mm-hmm. And the other ones are progressively being taken up by the community. Okay. So I see, of course, I mean, I come now more from metabolomics than from other omics. So of course I see the relevance of metabolomics to that field, but what's for you the big added value of using metabolomics in epidemiology?
Yeah, and I think you touched on an important point. As far as my circles, I think this is exactly true, that metabolomics still hasn't reached its really full reputation, if you could say that. Like genomics is being widely embraced by clinicians, and metabolomics still trying to get the word out there, how it would be useful because it's the most dynamic of the omes. And then that it makes it closest to the phenotype. So these dynamic changes could be a drawback, because it could be sensitive to anything, fasting, non-fasting. So there are more variables that you need to account for and be aware of. But it's also very relevant to disease and being able to produce biomarkers. So historically, metabolomics has successfully put out their traditional biomarkers. These are metabolites, and that's what we're trying to do, use those signatures and perturbations to get you closer to what is actually happening, as opposed to in genomics, what could happen.
Mm-hmm. I guess for that, studies that look either at very early stages or very young age, or longitudinal studies that study people for a very long time, will help us also to demonstrate this, right? Because so these are really the studies. I'm happy to see this is also, or I'm happy to see, it's terrible what you find in those studies, but that, you know, where I feel that metabolomics is being put to good use.
Yeah.
That way.
Yeah, but you touched on an important point, I think, that I learned personally is temporality and the problem with cross-sectional design, as opposed to where you want to really define, are the metabolites the outcome or the exposure? And if they're exposure, are they measured prior to your outcome or not? So being aware of those epidemiological fundamentals, I think is very important when designing a metabolomic study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. In our preparation for this episode, we kept going back to the idea that you have to plan your experiment well, that the study design is really key. And of course, this rings a bell for me, because this is a point I'm trying to make in the podcast and also in discussion, especially with young scientists, that if you design your study well, if you plan it well, not only will you have more probably good results, but also you sell yourself a lot of trouble. So in the context of your work, where you work with epidemiological kind of studies, what would be for you some really important points for study design that you've learned along the way that you could share with our audience?
Yeah, most importantly is to define your outcomes and your exposure and your research question. And with that, some of it might be under control, but in many cases, it is not. This work depends a lot on collaborations, on existing cohorts, existing maybe RCTs that after the study's already been conducted, then researchers are interested into adding metabolomics, right? So I think practically, just being aware of the limitations is very mm-hmm. important. Is your study cross-sectional? Is it prospective? Is it retrospective? Are you able to capture your metabolites at several time points?
So yeah, because depending on the type of study, you're going to use metabolomics in a different way, and you're going to ask different questions.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think one example mm-hmm. that came maybe from also, it is definitely part of study design, is how to define your outcome. And we'll touch a little bit when we talk about like childhood obesity, but we also had really, I think it was a huge learning experience when I first started my postdoc in defining metabolic syndrome in children. So central adiposity is one component of metabolic syndrome, but it's really a cluster of impaired lipid, higher blood pressure, and dysglycemia. So that, mm-hmm. how do you capture that? And in adults, it is tricky, but there are cutoffs, you know, and if you have 3 out of five, so low HDL, high triglycerides, impaired or hypertension, diabetes or prediabetes, and waist circumference above, you know, certain cutoffs, then you're defined as having the metabolic syndrome. But then in children at age five, and we looked at a cohort of, we had like 500 children. Basically, if you're strict to the adults' cutoffs, you end up having 3 cases. So how do you deal with that? And so with that, there's a big, again, challenge that there is no consensus on defining the metabolic syndrome in the pediatric world. So looking into the literature, and then what we ended up doing is using a great method that was out there by a pediatric group in Germany, where they did it's called the EDIFIX cohort. So they had a cohort of 27,000 children, and they've derived normative data of these different components of the metabolic syndrome. And then out of that, you get a continuous score. So instead of our outcome change from a dichotomous yes, no metabolic syndrome to a continuous mm-hmm. graded score of 0 would be average. If you have mm-hmm. a positive score, that's higher risk. Negative score means a lower risk. And so it's all standardized based on Z values. And that really gave us statistical power, and it gave us a way to investigate metabolites associated with that score.
Mm-hmm.
So I this was kind of my first jump into epidemiology.
Well, yeah, that's a big jump. Yeah. But I guess in terms of cardiovascular disease, there are lots of diseases that would benefit from this kind of continuous scoring rather than a binary yes or no diagnosis. It seems relevant for many of the chronic diseases that we look at the moment.
Exactly that, Alice. Dysglycemia is really a continuum reflecting metabolic perturbations that are not really just a one cutoff. And same for a problem for gestation diabetes, that you would see that now the consensus in to have different cutoffs also based on your ethnicity, because the one cutoff might put an ethnicity there at higher risk, and you wouldn't be classified as gestational diabetes based on that cutoff, but you are actually having all the metabolic perturbations occurring, right?
Mm-hmm. So at least for this study, you were looking at it from the perspective of pediatric patients, but this really goes also in the direction of precision medicine in general, to get a subset of the population that is closest to each individual so that they get references that match their own biology, and not to try and fit a single individual into the overall picture of the whole population. Yeah. Especially if your sample of the population is relatively biased, which it often is, then you get entire parts of the population that are left out and that look like outliers or that are not diagnosed when they should be diagnosed, for example.
Yeah, I think this is a great point you're making, Alice. Like, and in the community is really now striving towards diversity, ethnic mm-hmm. diversity in precision medicine.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was a point you were addressing in the poster that you presented at MedSug this year, isn't it?
Yeah, we are doing a metabolomic study in South Asian women mm-hmm. with gestation diabetes mm-hmm. to find metabolites that can predict future type 2 diabetes. And the reason why is that South Asians are at a twofold higher risk of having gestation diabetes than white Europeans. Mm-hmm. So there's already that ethnic susceptibility, and that requires that we designed our studies and our cohorts mm-hmm. very targeted towards diversity.
And do you find that metabolomics is a particularly good tool to study these kind of ethnic differences, for example? Or is it one of many tools and there are other ways that you would rather address it? I don't know.
Well, I haven't done lots of work into, like, you know, genomics is definitely is able to detect ethnic differences. So it might be a multi-omic approach really that is needed.
Yeah, that makes sense. I don't know if there are any other aspects of the strategy that you use in your work that you would like to address in terms of tools or of statistical analysis, or are there things that you always do or things that you never do that you'd like to put forward?
I think just a general strategy in our group is really the multidisciplinary teams that we have. So being able to reach out to people with statistical expertise, with clinicians, like really that strategy is very important, that I don't have the answers, but I know who can help with that, and knowing who to reach out to and thinking together and taking the perspective of different specialists and different experts combined.
That's a great point. That's a really great point. Probably one of the best advice you can give someone who works in a field that is really complex and that requires a lot of expertise. In the end, it's very rare that someone will be an expert, have all the things that they need to do, especially these days when we start combining lots of different technologies together and disciplines. So I agree with you. This is probably one of the best advice you can give a scientist.
Yeah, especially as a younger scientist, ambitious, don't pressure yourself into trying to have
it all. Absolutely. And thank you. To introduce the paper that we'll discuss today, so this will be about childhood obesity, but I wanted to ask you about some of the new metrics around obesity, because I heard from you BMI is really not the great tool that we used to think it is to evaluate obesity. So what are some of the ways BMI failing in terms of measuring obesity or detecting it? And what are hopefully better ways to look into it?
Yeah, I think this is a global problem. The World Obesity Federation did kind of an overview where different countries are in terms of achieving that goal, that the childhood obesity levels will not be higher in 2025 than they were in 2012. And what they found is that less than 10% of the countries are going to reach that goal. So the problem is huge, but if you look into the details of the report, what metric is used is BMI. And because it is a good metric, it's when you look at the population level, it can help stratify low and high risk, easy to measure, but it fails on being careful with different ethnic susceptibilities. So if you look at India or South Asians, you would find that obesity levels are very low. But because BMI does not capture central adiposity, which tends to be more in South Asians, so that is the fat around the belly or the central obesity, which a better metric for would be waist circumference. So in that paper, we try to compare the metabolic signature or the metabolites associated with BMI versus waist circumference versus a third metric called sum of skinfold thickness, which is the biceps or triceps. You know, if you pinch the child's triceps and biceps, how much of that would be coming out as skinfold thickness, and you sum that up. And that's another metric used. Actually, we were very surprised that there isn't much overlap between the three metrics in terms of which metabolites were associated with BMI. You will find that different metabolites were associated with each metric. So it depends really, again, how do you find your outcome? And waist circumference was actually the one metric with the highest number and most significant associations in terms of metabolite.
Okay. So you've already revealed some of the findings, but it's a good introduction to these different metrics as well, because the one of the tricep fold thing, I had never heard of that before. So for me, it's a new one. Yeah. The paper that we'll discuss today is called Early Sex Dependent Differences in Metabolic Profile of Overweight and Adiposity in Young Children, a Cross-Sectional Analysis. And this was published in BMC Medicine in 2023, and you're the first author. And before we go deeper into the results, I mean, you've explained a bit the background, but what made you look specifically for for these young children below under the age of five, and also what made you stratify the data by sex? Because this is something that is done more and more, which is good, but it's still, it's not the way that it used to be in general. So what made you want to go there?
Yeah, so two things. I think just from the title, our outcome is overweight and adiposity. So what we've tried to do is, again, that idea of using a metric that is more accurate. So we combined both BMI and waist circumference into defining that problem of overweight and adiposity in young children. And why did we want to do a metabolomics analysis into that early age? It's part of the DOHA theory. Again, we're trying to track early perturbations. And maybe there is an ongoing study to track even earlier during pregnancy. But for this cross-sectional view, we saw an opportunity in those cohorts, existing birth cohorts that we had. So this is done in the largest Canadian birth cohort called Child, and that had 900 children. And then we also had a second cohort called Family with 456 children, where we've replicated. So the cohorts gave us the opportunity to be able to look into that time point. And why did we stratify by sex, or also why that young age? I think a very important resource when we were doing that study was a systematic review of metabolomic studies of childhood obesity. So with that, and I'd like to give a shout out. The first author is called Handikas et al., and it's obesity reviews. I don't know the authors, but that resource has been very, very rich. Mm-hmm. So before we go on to the study, we go to the literature. What is out there? And I think this is a call for more researchers in metabolomics to conduct such systematic reviews. So again, the combination of epi with metabolomics and yes. From that study, which was published in 2021, there were in the field 41 metabolomic studies of childhood obesity. Okay. And they've tried to see which signals are already out there. And when we looked at the study, nothing really was done in early childhood. There was more towards average age of 9 years of age, or there were studies that were conducted from having a really wide age range from 1 year up to 13. So it wasn't really looking specifically at that stage of life. So we took that opportunity. Yeah. I think it was the first study to look at that early childhood.
And through reading your paper, I also learned that insulin resistance usually becomes apparent around puberty. So I guess a lot of people had rather looked at, let's say, teenagers rather than young children, probably thinking that there would be more to see there. But this is also maybe one reason why there was not so much work that had been done in those early years.
Yeah, exactly.
Which was missing a big point, because you found a lot of things. So there was definitely something there, even though insulin resistance was not measurable yet. Mm-hmm. But I really like your point about the value of the systematic review. Sorry to just go back to that. I've had a few people tell me this also in the past, and I feel the same too, because it takes a lot of work to make those reviews, and people sometimes wonder, like, why should I spend my time doing this? And often people do this in preparation for a PhD, or like at the beginning when they research the literature. And I think it's a really great thing to do, because you always do this as you start your work. You always screen the literature to see what has been done, what exists, and to put it in a systematic way like this for other people to understand is really valuable. So I would also encourage people, especially if you do that search in the literature, like go the extra mile and publish it, because it's really valuable for others as well.
Yeah. And it opens up your research path. Mm-hmm. So it did help us like decide that we are going to move up with a sex stratified analysis, because there is a small section on that, but also in puberty. So nothing's catching the pre or early childhood phase. Again, the marriage of chemistry and epidemiology, systematic reviews are very common in in health research methods and epidemiology. So just using that into, but if you don't have the chemistry, you can't really understand the metabolomic studies. So really that working together across disciplines to create such systematic reviews would be very helpful to the field. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that might have jumped us to the last questions.
Okay. And so Well, once you had your mindset on the population you wanted to look at and how you wanted to do your experiment, did you face any specific challenges? So either defining those questions or finding the cohorts to work with or the methods, like were there any specific aspects that were particularly difficult in this study?
I was privileged to have access to the cohorts and to be given that project to work on. And so they were existing. And it's the idea that, you know, from a funder's perspective, or from here in Canada, research is really funded by taxpayers' money, right? So to understand the value of why we need to run those cohort studies, which are expensive to run, right? And to longitudinally mm-hmm. follow up a pregnant mom, and then at birth, and then later on, at 3 years, at 5 years, some of the studies, of course, now are doing the 10-year follow-up. I think that could be a challenge if the resource is not existing. To me, it was there. I know in many countries, the opposite just happens, is that the resource is there, but no one is using the data. So I think to maximize use of such rich resource, which are birth cohorts or population perspective cohorts. And then...
So maybe my question should be questioned the other way around. So rather, like, the fact that these cohorts were available was probably also something that encouraged you to actually run that study.
Exactly.
Like in a much more positive light. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
That challenge.
Exactly. Like, and previous, like previous work, you know, done would look into clinical factors associated with metabolomic kind of layer is... It was novel to these cohorts. So,
is it also an advantage when you apply, because you have to apply for those cohorts, right, to get access to the samples and to be allowed to use them and measure them? Do they also ask you whether the data will be available for other people to mine, for example? Like, is there an aspect like this of making the data available afterwards? How does it work?
Yeah, that is a very important point of like publicly available data. And so far, those cohorts have been in the publication that is available upon request, because in the original consent forms, the patients did not consent to having the data publicly published. And here comes really an important point in research ethics, also in open source data. So it is a point to be considered.
Because in the end, especially for cohorts or for biobanks, it's best when you can measure once and then reuse the data afterwards. So I guess they are happy to have data that can be reused or that can be combined later on in different studies, for example. But of course, to enable this, the consent has to be adequate and the patients have to agree to have their information.
Yeah. And I think there are attempts to go back to the patients because
it's tough, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of these cohorts started 10 years ago or even more. So that would be a challenge. But moving forward, I think the UK Biobank is pioneering that work in making publicly available data. But again, the question mark is how diverse is it? So it's we have to keep on, I think, trying to reach equity within that as well.
Thanks. And so we've discussed already, we've had a glimpse of the results of this study. So you have your three metrics of obesity and adiposity. Mm-hmm. Is it only obesity? I'm conscious now. I'm not remembering. Sorry. But so you have your three metrics and you looked at the metabolites that associate with them. And as you mentioned already, there is actually no single metabolite that overlaps between the three, which is really interesting.
Yes, there wasn't.
But there were, of course, overlaps between the different ones. So how did you go forward with those results, and what is your recommendation to go forward when you see this metabolomic profiles of these children?
So this specific analysis of looking continuously at associations between metabolites and BMI or waist circumference and some skin folds was really supporting what we're recommending here and what we did into combining those metrics when you define your outcome. So this was kind of like a secondary analysis. So in our main analysis is we defined cases and controls, and the cases were defined not just on BMI above the 75th percentile, which is what defines overweight in children. So we combined that with also another criteria, which was if the waist circumference is above 90th percentile, that would also count as cases. And we found that most cases did have both, did satisfy both, but there were some cases that will not really overweight, but they had a waist circumference above the 90th percentile, which is based on several pediatric guidelines, is requires a monitoring level. So this is kind of alert. So when combining these two metrics, we looked into cases of overweight or adiposity. That's our outcome, how we define it, and which metabolites were associated with the cases compared to controls. And what we found was that we, especially when you're looking at the systematic review, we found that that signature that is already established in many other studies, we were able to also see at 5 years, which is signature of branched-chain amino acids, aromatic amino acids, tyrosine, phenylalanine, and threonine was one that wasn't reported before. So we could see a signal associated with overweight and adiposity using that combined metric, and it was consistent with what's reported in older children. And then we did this sex stratified analysis. And should I go with what we found?
What did you find there?
Yeah, please. Yeah, what we found there was very surprising, that the signal was mostly driven by girls. So if you stratify all of the consistent, we had 11 significant metabolites. They're all significant in girls, but not in boys. Although the trend is there in boys, so the trend of the association is maintained, but it's a stronger signal in girls. So the perturbations are stronger in the girls than the boys at age 5. We don't know why yet.
Yeah.
But we went and we actually validated that in an independent cohort, which is the family cohort. Not all the 11 metabolites were replicated, but 6 of them were. So again, valine, phenylalanine, tyrosine. And what we found again was the same, that the signal was stronger in girls than boys.
This is really interesting. And it's also, I looked at a lot of publications that we're looking into branched chain amino acids or aromatic amino acids in adults. You always see this difference also between men and women in the levels, especially of branched chain amino acids. And it seems to be really related to the sex, but you might, let's say in adults, you have, to some extent, you have a lifestyle, an impact of lifestyle that might be larger than in children, especially under the age of 5. So from branched chain amino acids, they're like, because these are essential amino acids. So they come from the diet, they might come from the microbiome, but they come from the outside. And so you think, okay, lifestyle might be different between men and women. Have you asked yourself, like in children under the age of 5, is there already a lifestyle difference that could contribute to this?
We know in puberty that does contribute, because from other work in the literature, we know boys during puberty tend to be more active, and then when designing intervention, they respond better with like for weight reduction. But at age 5, we did try to, you know, to the best of our knowledge, to adjust for confounders. So in that we adjusted based on like our choice of covariates or confounders was based on the literature as well as the data itself. So breastfeeding was a big confounder into, so it is protective against overweight and adiposity. It's a good message to get out there. But we adjusted for that. We adjusted for child sleep, which we saw a signal there. So we tried to really adjust for those lifestyle differences between boys and girls. So I think it might be more, like one of the hypotheses that we put is through the process of mitochondrial metabolic adaptation, maybe happening differently between boys and girls. How much is it to lifestyle, and how much is it to programming? We don't know yet.
It is a really interesting finding. And so, what would be your recommendations then, based on what you found, and especially these differences between boys and girls? Should we be careful in the way that we screen for these diseases and make a difference, like really specific markers or metrics for boys and girls, for example?
I think it could help in risk assessments. That idea of trying to get a more accurate assessment of cardiovascular risk, and sex has to be considered in it, and maybe metabolic biomarkers can also help in that. And accordingly, you would design interventions, maybe just lifestyle interventions, but it could be more than that in later years.
Yeah. Thank you. Is there anything else about the paper that you'd like to bring up?
Just a caveat.
You would like to do.
Yeah. Sure. It is cross-sectional analysis, right? So that's That is one caveat. So a prospective longitudinal follow-up would be great. So that's what we are trying to also achieve as next steps is, okay, you see those perturbations and they're associated cross-sectionally at age five, but mm-hmm. is this signature also associated with overweight or obesity at age 10? How long does it persist? So I think that's an important question to answer in within that cohort or other international cohorts. Perhaps we would have metabolomics data and follow-up already completed. So that would be mm-hmm. very useful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That was a really interesting paper, and I'm happy we got to discuss it.
You're happy to revive it. Get it out.
And so maybe following from that experience and the other studies that you've done, the question I would have for you now is, knowing what metabolomics can do and the kind of details that it can detect as well. So in your sense, from your experience and how you see the world of science and medicine, what do you see the biggest impact of metabolomics in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I might be biased in my answer, but I think really trying to achieve and pushing getting biomarkers out there in the clinic. So the push of from what we call from benchtop to bedside is to try to, if we like rigorously study our research questions and follow up on and do validation or application, we are able to deliver really good biomarkers from metabolomics to the clinic. Because routinely, this is what glucose has been doing, uric acid, all the traditional conventional clinical mm-hmm. chemistry, it is the same. But now we have such broader coverage. And with that, I think the challenge is that we ideally need absolute quantitation mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. vital to be able to compare between studies, to be able to see if you can have generalizable cutoffs for the biomarkers.
Mm-hmm. And since we now know that ethnicity, sex, and other variables really influence what would be the normal range or the pathological range of such markers, do you think we should also, since if we make new sets of markers, should we already begin by doing them, thinking of the stratification of the population into these different groups so that we might have a global signature, but with different subsets for different parts of the population or different ranges for different parts of the population? Would that make sense?
I think that would be fantastic. Okay. That's an amazing mm-hmm. point, Alice, to really look into as personalized as possible. Right? Is that what you're, in terms of age, yeah. sex, ethnicity?
Maybe that's where AI will make a useful contribution as well to help us get to that granularity without getting too detailed either, because of course you have also the risk of going too much in the detail and then you lose the specificity of your markers. And where would you see the biggest hurdle in order to achieve this? Where do you see the main limitation from your perspective? Thing we should work on?
Yeah, I think it's a hurdle and a challenge and an opportunity. Mm-hmm. But I think that point now where we're trying to collaborate and validate each other's findings, or like really how to merge instead of each lab is working in silos, but how to merge that power into something that is really impactful. So with
very
that
point,
a challenge is the overlap between the metabolome coverage between labs is very small, right? So how do you validate if there's not much overlap? And mm-hmm. it will get better as technology is getting better. Like branching amino acids, everybody's
exactly.
measuring.
I was thinking like amino acids are always there.
Yeah.
And there are really a lot of usual suspects that you see coming up, even with untargeted methods. So I think the overlap is not that bad, actually. And then if you use untargeted, then you still have, of course, a couple of things that others might not pick up. But overall, there's also because the number of metabolites that are annotated is rather limited. So in comparison to what exists, so that's also a reason probably. But yeah, I agree with you. I think it's a really good point that you see a lot of people working in parallel, looking for biomarkers for this or that disease. And most people work on the same disease as well. So there are much fewer people working on rare diseases than working on the main cardiovascular chronic diseases. So that would make a lot of sense. Yeah. I hope we manage to do this. That would be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. A mega meta-analysis. So going back to epidemiology, that's also of the top, maybe promising panels of biomarkers.
Yeah. And so this takes us to the last question. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
So what's your favorite metabolite and why?
Okay, so I was going to say tyrosine because it was an early biomarker from that work earlier than branching amino acid of insulin resistance. But I will also like to say, because we didn't touch at all on the dietary nutrient metabolomics, dietary biomarkers, so I'll choose C15, pentadecanoic acid. So it's a fatty acid that comes from my PhD work. I like it because I measured it. I created in our lab developed a method to quantify it. And why I like it is that it's coming from full fat dairy. So it's a good marker for full fat dairy. It's exogenous. So it won't be confounded by any endogenous transformation or metabolism. And it's a good marker for full fat dairy, and it has been shown to be protective of diabetes. So in the EPIC study, which I think was the largest of a fatty acid analysis study, 27,000 participants, on chain fatty acids were found protective of type 2 diabetes. So I like C15.
That's an interesting choice. Thanks. And there is indeed a lot of interest in on-chain fatty acids and also the lipids that are incorporating these on-chain fatty acids. So I think there's a lot of people who will like this choice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Everyone doesn't like milk and cheese, right?
Well, I love milk and cheese, but I'm slash, so it's normal. Thank you very much for taking part in the podcast. It was lovely discussing with you.
Thank you so much for having me. That was an exciting experience.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to The Metabolomist. I hope that this episode got you excited about the upcoming applications of metabolomics and that it motivated you to support science that brings a positive impact to our lives. To make sure you never miss an episode, register to our newsletter on the podcast webpage, themetabolomist.com. To learn more about metabolomics and how to plan your own projects, check out my book on metabolomic data interpretation at biocrates.com/thestoryprinciple. And don't forget to connect with me, Anisline Moussiel, on LinkedIn to continue the conversation on the many ways that metabolomics impacts health, research, and our lives.